Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for tuning in to the Big Honker Podcast. It is always a lot of fun to do these, and we appreciate everybody that listens to our debauchery. And we appreciate Tony fucking just coughing in the background. Spreading that COVID. Harry coughing in the background. No respect. No respect to our personal bubble, Jeff.
Right here at Studio A at the Big Honker Podcast, brought to you by Shin Gear Waiters. Folks, if you're going to buy you some waiters, you're going to buy waiters every single year. There's guys on here listening right now that buy a pair of waiters every year.
And they dread it every year. Yep. Oh, damn, I wish somebody would come out and make a good pair of waiters.
So you got to call waiters, but you got to pay a little bit for them, but they got a lifetime guarantee. So look up Shin Gear Waiters, and they have waiters in stock right now. Holler at them at shingear.com.
Shingear.com. They're built out of nylon. And like Jeff said, they got a promise that they will stand behind their waiters for as long as you'll stand in them. So check them out at shingear.com, and you better hurry because supplies are limited. So if you want a pair of the best waiters on the market, go check them out. We're also brought to you by Bangtail Whiskey. Enjoy a traditional corn mash whiskey, aged in charged new American oak barrels. You'll find a pleasant aroma of vanilla spice before galloping in a note of nougat, sweet corn, and a lingering caramel finish. Built on a dream, aged 25 years, handcrafted Bangtail whiskey will create the perfect sip no matter how you drink your whiskey.
Other than all that fancy shit, does it taste good, Andy?
It is very good. There I do my go. Whiskey sours out of it. You can drink it straight, however you want to do it. Bangtail whiskey is the way to go. They can even ship it to you. You go to bangtail.com, and it will go right to your door. Bangtail.com. We're also brought to you by Pacific Calls, the boys up in Spokompton.
Trevor and Alex.
You'll never meet two better guys in the waterfowl industry.
Good people. I mean, good product.
Seriously. You can call them up at any time. Tell them what you're looking for. They're incredibly knowledgeable. Kind of about, you know, they can talk to you about maybe your skill set, and they can find a call that is best for you. The PCD is still one of the best duck calls that's on the market right now, and I like their 206. It's what I use for lessers. And you need to check them out at pacificcustomcalls.com, or you can call them however you want to get a hold of them, and they can find you a call that will work best for you. They're actually making Reese his first goose and duck call.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
So that's going to be here for his birthday. Talked to Trevor, and he said absolutely we'd be happy to do it.
That is awesome.
You will not meet a better group of guys. So check them out, pacificcustomcalls.com. We're also brought to you by Boss Shot Shells. Listen, the shortage is real. If you want shotgun shells for this coming waterfowl season, you better order them now. And if you're a snow goose hunter that hunts in February, you definitely need stuff in the closet tucked away. Boss Shot Shells, all American-made products, shipped straight to your door, and it hits like a freight train. Bismuth is the way to go.
Another group of great guys, American-made, American craftsmen, Boss Shot Shells.
That's at BossShotShells.com. We're also brought to you by Dirty Duck Coffee. If your coffee sucks, it ain't the duck. It's how we start our morning out here at the Big Honker Lodge every single morning. Made here in the great state of Texas. They've got a blend for you no matter what you like, whether you're a high-caffeine kind of guy or a mid-roast, whatever. They've got a blend for you. DirtyDuckCoffee.com, and you can pick what you want, and it'll go right to you. They've also got incredible-looking swag. I like their shirts. DirtyDuckCoffee.com has got the best way. And they've also got a sampler pack, so you can get all their blends shipped straight to your door. We're also brought to you by Lucky Duck. The tops for those 2x4 blinds.
Game changer.
Might be the best invention that they've ever come up with.
My grand dog is going to be riding around in comfort with a brand new crate, extra large crate for his extra large big ass.
Yep.
A pad in there.
And a fan.
And I think we're working on getting him a flat screen TV so he can watch Scooby-Doo on his way to the hunts every morning.
Lucky Duck is working on the technology right now. But yes, if you've got a plus size dog like my big boy Lou, they now have a 5-star crash test rated dog kennel that you can safely put your dog in and not have to worry about him, you know, if something bad happens on the road. Listen, hunting season, roads get icy. You want to protect your buddy? Put that big ass pad back there. Also, if you need a spinner, a A-frame blind, they're the way to go. And now, if you're a crane hunter, you can put those tops on the 2x4 blind and don't have to worry about the cranes seeing the boogeyman in there. So I would check them out at luckyduck.com. We're also brought to you by Dive Bomb Industries, the leader in silhouette manufacturing. Great guys there, too. That is one thing about our sponsors is every one of them is top-notch people, and they go out of their way for their customers. Dive Bomb.
Except for the fat bastard at Stanfield Hunting.
Yeah, he's a little bit of a dick. You're talking about Tony.
Yep.
Dive Bomb Industry, if you need silhouettes, they are the way to go. As always, you want to get the bag so that they pack up nice and neat, and you can stay organized during hunting season. It does not matter what you're chasing. They have got a decoy for you, whether it is Canada geese, specks, snows, ducks. They've got Canada floater line that they're really excited about. They're also coming out with the kickstand. Be looking for it whenever they say that they've got some in stock. If you want it, you better jump on it.
Guys, if you're hunting a pond, southwest Oklahoma, northern Nebraska, wherever, you're hunting on a stock pond, take, and you got a bank you're going to hunt on, take you two dozen of those duck silhouettes and stick them on there. It makes your spread look so completely different. I'm telling you, the colors pop on them. It's a game changer. It's an inexpensive way to add your spread to kill a lot of ducks. So look up at divebombindustries.com.
That's the way to go. We're also brought to you by Gundog Outdoors. Listen, they've got a couple products that I think everybody should need. If you're a waterfowl hunter and you got a dog that likes to, you know, go when the shot is called, you need the quick release system. It's a patented, which means it's extra fancy. You clip it onto your dog's collar and it's got a leash on it. That dog does not go anywhere until you let him. You just pull the little quick release and away he goes. It's super simple to use. This cheap and effective quick release system can be the difference between life and death. So I would highly recommend, all it takes is one. So every dog, I think, as a safety measure, you could use it. They've also got their field trauma kit. Hunting is a dangerous sport. Just every day you can cut yourself on a knife. It doesn't matter. They have tools in this field trauma kit that I think every hunter should have in their blind bag and in their pickup truck because, it's just the nature of the beast. Plus, Alex Langbell, he's a super great guy, and he's taken a lot of time to kind of figure out what they needed in this field trauma kit, and he had to figure out a way to make this quick release system work, and they both work. So check them out at Gundog Outdoors and take care of that four-legged friend of yours. We're also brought to you by the Looking Glass Duck Club podcast. You put enough pressure on them, they are back going. You go to Patreon and you become a cult member, and you can listen to all of their podcasts. Their entire library is up on Patreon. The bourbon reviews are free to anybody, so if you just want to listen to the bourbon review, that's free. That's about 20 minutes, and it's free to everybody. But if you want to get to the meat and potatoes of things, donate to their Patreon account, and then you can listen to Logan and Rebel talk a bunch of shit. They're a lot of fun to listen to, and they're great guys. So check them out at the Looking Glass Duck Club podcast. We're also brought to you by Goose Creek Retrievers, Mr. Matt Peel. He is touring the world. Got hunt tests all over, and I think he's
stacking up them ribbons.
Just ribbons galore for Mr. Matt Peel. He's a great guy, incredibly knowledgeable about training labs and hunting dogs, and it's a lot of fun. You should definitely follow him on Instagram, Goose Creek Retrievers. And if you have any questions or if you've got a dog that you want to send off and have Matt train it, professionally trained, check him out. I'm sure he'll be more than happy to.
From a started to a finished dog, he can take care of it all.
Whatever you need. He's a one-stop shop. That's at Goose Creek Retrievers. We're also brought to you by EyeSight Drones. It's the way to go now. Technology is just taking over. Don't guess what your crop's going to look like. Don't guess where your water's going to come from. Have them come fly your property. They can do animal counts. Takes the guesswork out of everything.
It's 2021. Get with the times.
Get with the times, people. The use for drones is endless, and they're going to be a part of society whether we like it or not for here on out, and it will save you a lot of steps. And like I said, if you've got a question about your property, your duck hole coming up for this waterfowl season, contact them, and they can fly it and give you a survey of what it looks like. That's at eyesightdrones.com. Last but not least, we're brought to you by Stanfield Hunting Outfitters. We've made it through most of dove season, a lot of dove season.
Half of dove season's over. Folks, if you want to shoot some ducks, holler at me. We have some prime Oklahoma dates left. Yes, I'm pushing this. This is new for us on the duck hunt. No, not new for us to shoot ducks, but we're really, really pushing on the ducks. Do a lot more duck hunting. So holler at us in Oklahoma to shoot ducks. We still got cranes and geese in Texas left. But if you want to shoot some ducks, and shoot something besides ringnecks and redheads wherever you're hunting and you want to shoot some puddle ducks, holler at us for Oklahoma Hunts. I've got a few dates left in December, and I got some January dates still left. But that's at stanfieldhunting.com, or call me, and I will answer the phone myself, 940-658-3172.
You're going to feel like a real dickhead if they shoot a bunch of ringnecks that day.
Well, I will, but I'll blame it on you.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, this episode of the podcast, we are joined by Mr. Coulter Barnes. He went 67 days out in the Alaskan wilderness on the hit television show Alone. Oh, what a fascinating man. We talk about his time on the TV show and some of the struggles he went through, and it was, fascinating podcast. We hope that you enjoy it as much as we enjoyed making it. Here he is, Coulter Barnes. Here we go. 3, 2, 1.
Boom, and welcome to the Big Honker Podcast, brought to you by Shin Gear Waiters. I am Jeff Stanfield with the world-famous fucking Andy Shaver. And
do you have to drop the F-bomb on that? I mean, you make it seem kind of crude, and it's not as tasteful. Just world-famous, we'll work.
Fucking world-famous Andy Shaver.
Shin Gear does have waiters in, so if you need a pair, you better hurry up and get on the ball and order them.
And sitting with us on the table today, and the goose is Dad. Dad's ashes are in the goose between us. So, with us today, from Alaska, from the show, the hit series Alone on the History Channel, Mr. Coulter Barnes. Coulter, how are you doing, sir?
Hey, I'm doing good, Jeff. Andy, thanks for having me, you guys.
We're excited to talk to you. I got to tell you, that there's a lot of like these survivor type shows, but Alone, that's a tough one because it's just you and your thoughts for however long you can handle it.
It's the real deal. It is, there's no camera crews, there's no gimmicks. You know, they're not asking you to recreate this scene or that scene. It's you out there alone and trying to document surviving out there. So it's, yeah, it definitely, after going through that experience, I can say for 100%, it is the real deal. There's nothing staged. They're not trying to, you know, pin your drama against this contestant or that contestant. It's you, in your wits, trying to survive.
So my question is how do they give you fresh camera gear every week during the medical checks, or how do you get your batteries charged?
Yeah, so they do big battery drops. So you have four cameras, and you have, you know, everything's in a big Pelican case, and you have tons of batteries. You must have 100, 150 batteries at any time. You have these little Pelican cases of SD cards. Right. And so for those fill up, it could be 10 or 20. They figure out kind of each contestant's schedule. Maybe some shoot it all in 10 days, some in 20, but they come and drop them on the beach. A lot of times you don't even see them. And so they'll say, hey, there's a dry bag. Put all your dead batteries and your old SD cards in there, and we'll drop you a dry bag off with fresh ones and just leave them on the beach. So and yeah.
They just this is my deal. Or I've watched this show for many years, and I told a guy today at the post office about it. I said, told him you were going to be on with us and stuff. He goes, is it like Survivor? I said, no. I said, they're not voting somebody off the fucking island. I said, you can stay. You could still be staying out there if you wanted to. It's about alone. You're by yourself out there. How do they sneak in without you hearing them to do that, to drop off some shit?
Well, they'll come in. They're not trying to fool anyone. They're like, there was a time or two that I saw them down there, but they'll just tell you, you have your little yellow brick, your GPS device that texts, and they'll say, hey, tomorrow we're going to do a battery drop at noon. Or around then, and so make sure you have your bag of batteries down there by noon. But you're out hunting, trapping, and fishing. Like, you're not going to stand there and shake hands with them. Like, you got to go get food. And so a lot of times I'd leave it down there in the morning, and I'd go out hiking, hunting, fishing, doing whatever, and they'd come in and replace it, and I'd pack it up in the evening. But yeah, they're not trying to sneak on you. If you want to be standing there and hand it off, they're fine, but they don't talk to you. That's the cool thing is, like, you know, the election was going on when I was out there, and there's different things going on. And so I'd always say, what's happening and who won and da-da-da-da-da. And they wouldn't even – they don't give you any information from the outside world. Oh, they kind of smile at you, hand you the bag, and then pull away.
Now, would they let you know – like, say something happened, like, with your family, and, like, they needed you to know. Would you get that information, or do you sign, like, some sort of agreement where we're not telling you anything?
Yeah, they give you an agreement that says, do you want to know if you have a family emergency? And so you have emergency contacts. Mine was my mother and father. And so some people say yes. Some people say no. I don't want to know until it's over. And some people say yes, I do want to know. But yeah, you sign a waiver for that.
Right.
When I think that this season of Alone, y'all got the shit into the deal on a place to go. Because y'all couldn't fish till 45 days in with that gill net.
Yeah, it was difficult. I think any place you go is probably going to be pretty difficult. But yeah, I mean, that regulation made sense. Like, as much as I take full responsibility for my shortcomings. It wasn't my site and it wasn't the regulations. It was my not being able to adapt and learn quick enough to live off the land, fast enough to be able to live off the land. But that being said, like, they have a salmon. They're helicoptering salmon around a landslide that blocked the river into the lake. So I get why. I think if that Chilco Lake, I think if that landslide wouldn't have happened, we'd have been able to use gill nets from day one. But they don't want to helicopter salmon. They're paying lots of resources to maintain that salmon run while they can clear that slide. And I don't think they want to drop them into our gill net. So while it made sense, it sure made it a lot more difficult, too.
Right.
What kind of duck was it that you ate that had the worms?
It was a woodpecker.
it was a woodpecker?
A woodpecker. Yeah, oh, it wasn't no. a woodpecker. I wish it was a duck. God.
So I didn't see this part. It had worms in it?
It was floating, and he found it. I thought it was a duck. He found a bird floating in the water. I just assumed it was a duck, and it was dead. And when he opened it up, it had – so that's somebody – that camera work was good because it looked like it was a lot bigger than a woodpecker. Boy, you were you were hungry.
Oh, man. I would never – I just wouldn't even think about finding something floating in the water, really. I mean, I don't know. I have pretty low standards when it comes to food, but I was hungry. And I hadn't eaten any red meat. I was going to eat anything that was floating out there. I don't care what it was. But yeah, it was great, man. It was delicious. And every little thing kind of just gets you through. And a lot of it's for morale. I mean, a lot of it, you know, isn't a whole lot of calories. You saw Biko get a fish that was 35 calories. But I think a lot of it's just for and to keep going.
Now, you said that you didn't adapt soon enough. What did you do wrong? Because you said you put all your eggs in the gill net basket. What else could you have done to have prolonged your stay?
Well, okay, so there's a lot of things that don't get shown on there. My story ended up being my boat, and I get that, and I understand why, and that's fine. I don't have any resentment towards what they showed or what they didn't. You know, I gave them 1,000 hours of footage, and they turned it into about 40 minutes of screen time, right?
Right.
So I was trapping. I had snares set up that I was checking, you know, frequently every day or two for rabbits. I was hunting like in the end of October. So in October, it was any buck. In September and November, it was 4-point only or better. And in October, it's any buck. So a lot of us obviously focus really hard in October at hunting. And I hunted the last 12 days of October every day until dark. Wow. And I was hiking back to camp in the dark. Well, they didn't show me hunting one time. That's okay. But so I guess my big thing was when I said, oh, there's another part. When you said, what did you do wrong? There was a landslide. Okay. Landslides are very productive. So if you ever find a landslide, that 20 years after a landslide, you have a lot of new growth, new vegetation, nutrients brought to the top of the surface, whether it's underwater. Where I set shrimp pots out here in Alaska is below a landslide. So whether it's below water or above water, they're very productive zones. Well, there was a landslide a couple miles away from my shelter or my little bay that I hiked to on day two and picked a gallon of cranberries. And there were bear trails and scat everywhere there. I mean, it was a very highly bear active zone. So I thought, well, you know what? I'm going to go get my shelter done, get my boat done, get some other things figured out. But I'm coming back to this landslide because it was this deciduous just path from the top of the mountain down. And it probably was 20 years old, 30 years old. And then everything else was conifer. And so where are the rabbits going to be? Where are the grouse going to be? Where are the deer going to be? Like, I think in that landslide. Well, by the time that I figured out, like it was like day 40, 45, and I was like, oh shit, Coulter, I remember that landslide? And I tried hiking there and I couldn't get there. I didn't have the energy. By the time I figured out where, you know, I remembered where I needed to be. I mean, that was on day two. I knew it. So I wish I'd have spent more time there. I wish I'd have set my snares there. I wish I'd have hunted there more. But by the time I figured that out, it was too weak. My zone of where I could go had shrunk.
Do you notice that as you're out there? Like, okay, I could go this far a week ago. And, oh, shit, now I'm only able to go half a mile. I can't go that extra half mile. Do you see your zone shrinking? And then do you kind of start to panic a little bit?
Well, it's gradual. I don't feel like, I panicked a whole lot, but it definitely was a gradual feeling. And it was pretty vertical country, so it wasn't flat. Anywhere I wanted to hike, anywhere from that lake for my site was vertical. And so you felt it. I'd side hill a lot and check my snares were going up this ridge where I was sitting, on my kind of had ground blinds, three different spots for deer hunting. And just getting to them, I felt weaker every time I got there. I felt more winded when I got there. And I thought to myself, I said, is this calorically efficient? Am I doing the best use of my calories? Could, being in a boat, you're rowing a bit here or there, but that's a nice way to move on top of the water. That's a very efficient way to move weight on top of the water. And so compared to hiking up and down mountains, and I wasn't seeing... I've hunted for 25 years. I'm sure no expert in deer hunting, but I've hunted mule deer, whitetails. I've bow hunted. I've rifle hunted. I feel pretty fairly adept at it. And I hunted for 67 days and didn't see one deer, not one.
Oh, my goodness.
I hunted till dark. I wanted to build a tree stand. Mm-hmm. And my goal was to build I had this really cool design that I thought I could pull off with very minimal paracord. And I couldn't find anywhere to build it. I couldn't find any game trails. I couldn't find anywhere they were moving. I found two sets of deer tracks in 67 days.
See, I think y'all got screwed on location because the guys that go to the Great Slave Lake, they had ox or musk ox that they got to shoot. They had moose. They had bears, but I'm not taking on a grizzly bear with a freaking stick. But they had more. They're more game. They had grouse. They had fish. They could do it. Y'all were. It was like putting y'all on a deserted island with nothing to eat.
It was pretty sterile. It was pretty sterile. And I don't think they're going to go back there again because people, it's more interesting TV when people are eating. It's not people sitting in their shelters just starving to death. But when you're actually eating food and you can hunt and fish and do all those different things, it makes for a better show. And I think they understood that. I think COVID hamstringed location. And so, because there were some provinces that said no, I believe, to the show coming in. So, yeah, it wasn't the most abundant. But, as Clay showed, it's a place that you could survive,
It's a tough time. I noticed that, the show, the $1 million show, they had better shelters than y'all did because they had more rocks, I noticed. You guys look like y'all were freezing your asses off.
Well, I don't know about that. Now, it'd be interesting to take the top few shelters from every season, but I like Teresa's Pit House. If you look at that latitude, if you look at people that have lived in that country at that latitude for thousands of years, indigenous folks around from Greenland and northern Canada and Alaska, they go underground in the winter because the soil temperature is warmer than the air temperature, so you go underground. So I thought her shelter was pretty slick. I like my shelter. They didn't show my shelter much, but where in your house is there the most insulation?
The roof. The roof.
Roof.
Ceiling.
Right? Heat rises. And so I had a 3-foot thick roof. I think a lot of people build A-frames and teepees and stuff like that. And you can't insulate those. And I think you have a lot of heat loss. So I felt pretty good in my shelter. I had a huge boulder that had a crack in it for my smoke and stuff to exit. So I felt pretty warm. But yeah, I don't know.
So it was warm. You weren't freezing the whole time?
Oh no. I mean, I didn't put on, to be honest with you, the 67 days that I was out there, I put my winter gear on 5 days. I wore my winter gear for 5 days. Otherwise I wore my rain gear, uninsulated rain gear, 62 of my 67 days.
Did you sleep well at night?
I slept good. About the first 15 days I didn't. And the last 50, I slept so solid. I slept really, really good. And I don't know what changed. My bed was uncomfortable as hell. It was started anything to fix it. Like, I have this, I can sleep when I'm uncomfortable, so I just never change it. But that was the most fucking uncomfortable bed I've ever slept on.
Now, you said at one point towards the end that you started dreaming about food. Does that fuck with you? Like, the next day, like, you know, you're hungry all day, and then you go to sleep because you want to try to get away from the hunger, and then it just torments you in your sleep. Is that fuck with you?
Well, it's interesting because I'm going to be honest with you. I didn't feel – okay, food gave me a lot of joy to think about. Every day when I was doing a task, I would just think about, like, today's theme would be gas station food. If I was at a gas station, what food would I get from there? If I was at the next day would be a Chinese buffet. If I was at a Chinese buffet, what would I get? And it was these fun ways of just like think, because I knew this was going to come to an end.
Right.
And I knew that I'd get that stuff, right? Well, it was like in the day, early 60s, I started thinking of eggnog milkshakes. Winter was coming. I was like, fuck, I'd give an eggnog milkshake with a little bit of rum in it. And then it started tormenting me. Like, that's when it turned from fun and playful to, my God, like, I need some eggnog now.
Now,
but yeah, it tormented me, but the dreams didn't, it was funny because the one dream that I remember having that was quite arousing was a buffalo. I dreamt of a buffalo liver.
Oh, wow.
So if you've dreamt of a buffalo, I dreamt of a buffalo liver and woke up and was drooling. So.
Now, you wanted to get a deer. What did you have, like a spear made that you were going to spear it with? How are you going to tackle this deer?
No, so I had a recurve. I had a bow and nine arrows that you got to take out there.
Okay,
so
I do remember seeing that.
And I with a compound bow in Montana and shot whitetail and elk and different things. So, like, I never hunted with a traditional bow. But I think, I got pretty good out to about 30 yards and felt like I knew hunting, like, knew what they like to do in the rut and how they behave, maybe where they're going to be elevation. Like, that's the other thing is we never got a great snowfall.
Right.
You know, I would have loved a foot or two of snow to drive those animals down from the top. They were high. I think they were up there really high. And that snow would just drive them down. And we never got it. We get a few inches and it'd melt a couple days later. And so you couldn't find hair, you know, rabbit tracks. And the game just wasn't moving down in elevation. I think they were still up high. And I couldn't get up high. So I go as high as I possibly could and sit for hours and call. Like, when it was during the rut, I'd call. And I would, I sat some places for 6 or 8 hours. Then I'd move around and, like, yeah, it was tough hunting.
What's the rules on if y'all run into someone out in the woods?
Well, if you run into, you're talking about another contestant or just someone else
just
out?
Just some guy that, say, lands a float plane in there and they're going to go hunt a group of guys.
Yeah, you're supposed to notify. So you're supposed to have as little contact as possible. They give you a protocol for that. So if people show up on a boat and they're fishing and you run into people, it's like, you know, don't go towards them, go away. And then if you need to, like, you know, notify them of your existence, but tell them, like, you know, da-da-da. There's kind of a whole protocol, but it's like, and then notify the show, like, if they're making camp in your spot or they're putting some area, like, you're supposed to notify production team. But yeah, I didn't see anyone, but they give you a bit of a protocol. I think other contestants did see, you know, I think there was some folks that were seen, but it didn't become an issue.
So you can't go over and bum a meal off of them or nothing.
And I would allow, everyone, like, whenever they'd come up for a med check, I would, like, tap people's pockets looking for a Snickers bar or something.
So how often do they check on y'all? Like, come to camp?
Yeah, not often. I think my first med check, I think it was about day 30 or 40 that my first med check was. And then it was about every 10 days after that. So say 30, 40, 50, 60, and then they did another one on 67 where I got pulled there.
Do they, do they let you know how many people are left or they don't tell you shit?
Oh, they don't tell you any of that. Like, and you start, you say in the beginning you're pretty nonchalant and cool. You're like, oh, it doesn't matter. Like, no, I don't need to know all this stuff. And then by day 50, you're like, okay, like, just tell me, like, wink at me if there's three people left or if there's more than three. You're like, dude, like, you start really fucking around with them, like, trying to get any information. Like, I'd be like, hey, what's Clay doing? Like, are you checking on Clay after me or before me? Or, like, there were some people that I figured were out there still. and you try to get information out of them, but they're good at what they do, man. They're efficient. They come in there and they front every trick in the book, and yeah.
So you did this in the midst of all the COVID stuff. You were like the safest person in the world because you're by yourself and anybody you see has on a mask. So
the interesting thing is I was living alone on an island during COVID.
Yeah.
And so my situation, I actually saw more people. They asked me why I was going on the show, and I told them for the social aspect. I said, "You're going on alone for the social aspect." He said, "Yeah, it's lonely as hell out here." Because I was working at a field school where we usually have students. So we had 10 student groups lined up last summer. Well, we canceled them all because of COVID. So I literally 2020 spent, the majority of my time on the island alone. And so I said, I got to go do something. I'm not going to sit out here alone on this island. So that's why I applied for the show in February.
So how does it, what are the steps and processes to being on this show? Because we have a lot of waterfowl hunters that listen to it. We got people from all over and do all things, but we got a lot of waterfowl hunters. And they're all the time, they'll make comments, I think I could do that shit.
I could do that shit.
There's very few people I know that legitimately would even have a chance of lasting 3 weeks out there. So what are the steps to get on the show?
Yeah, so I'll tell you my story. I'm not sure everyone's is the same, but I applied in February. I actually, it was interesting. I was sitting in the Seoul, South Korea airport. I was sleeping in the airport. There was like 7 people there. It was right at the beginning of COVID. And I said, my mom and dad had introduced me to this show in October, and I'd never even heard of it. And I was like, Jesus, you can go camping. If you can camp the longest, you get $500,000. Like, I'll apply for that. Sounds good. So I sent him an email with 3 pictures, a moose I'd killed, a brown bear I'd killed, and a bunch of salmon or something. And it was 2 lines in my email, like, hey, I live alone on this island in Alaska, interested in the show. And then I didn't hear from him until April. So I came back from a month-long trip overseas, and in April I got an email that said, hey, we'd like to talk with you. So then it was like an interview, okay? And then they said, hey, we would like you to go camping for a few days and send us 10 hours of footage. And they sent me a GoPro. So then I filmed 10 hours of footage. And then they said, another interview. And then they said, okay, you've made it to the top 20. So there's a boot camp. And so typically they do a boot camp in person. So they fly you all out to New York. And they end up, I don't know where at in New York, it's, in the woods somewhere up north or something, but they put you 20 together, and then every day kind of has a different theme, maybe shelter, fire building, water, food gathering, you have to butcher something, and the producers are there, and they are watching you, and they're interviewing, and they're seeing how personable you are, and if you make good TV, and then they narrow it to 10. Well, this year the boot camp was online. Again, they didn't want people traveling, they didn't want to bring everyone together, so it was like a Zoom week. So we had a whole week where we interviewed and demonstrated skills from our own home. So I like cut up a halibut, or I made a bow drill fire, or, did stuff like that. And so, and then after the boot camp, it was like August 1st when I got a call. I was down on the dock. The only place to get cell service out on the island there is down on the dock. And I got a phone call and they said, hey, you're on the show. Wow. And you have 3 weeks. We leave in 3 weeks. So
get your affairs in order, basically.
That's a hell of a story. Yeah. What's the now where y'all were at? Did y'all have squirrels and stuff?
Oh my God, there were squirrels everywhere. We couldn't hunt them. We couldn't trap them. We couldn't kill them.
Why?
Fever?
Right. So that's the thing, is the regulation. So there's like 3 layers of regulation, right? So we were on native land there. So they had their regulations because that was it's their land. And then there was provincial. It's the province of BC. They had regulations within the province. And then there was national regulations, right? And so the federal regulations. So all of them layered together, kind of, you couldn't kill mice. You couldn't kill squirrels. You couldn't kill salmon. And if they washed up on your beach, you couldn't eat them. You couldn't kill black bears. You couldn't kill brown bears. You couldn't kill moose. You couldn't kill does. It was 4-point only bucks or better. Except for the month of October, is any buck, and then you could kill grouse, but I couldn't use my gill net. Like, a lot of times you can build nets and catch birds and catch small game. You couldn't use a gill net for that. You had to use snares for rabbits, and you couldn't, and you had to hunt with a bow, grouse, and you could also hunt rabbits with a bow, but it was fairly restrictive, for sure. But like, we all had the same playing field.
Right.
So
now let me ask you this. let's say like it's truly a survivor situation, like you're in a plane crash, nobody knows you're there. Had you had no restrictions, do you think that you could have made it longer? Like if you would have been able to eat salmon, if you would have been able to, you know, any of that, do you think you could have made it longer?
100%. Yeah. I mean, I would have went after, I mean, like I would have been baiting bears out right. of the trees and I'd be baiting bears.
Yeah.
Like there ain't no animal. Like if you look at how people live in the North, like you need fat. And what animal out there has the most fat? What animal will come to bait? Bears. What was Patoka's up is Grizzly Mountain, you know? But like, yeah, there were bears around. Like that would have been, I mean, obviously then I would have been, you know, setting squirrel poles and snares, and I'd have been, you know, building as big a gill net as I wanted to, and I'd have had it out any day I wanted to, and I'd have been getting all, I'd have go to salmon spot, I'd have moved locations. You wouldn't have been hampered by your little square. And so like, but everyone would have probably survived longer, but a bear, like, you can live off of a bear and salmon, you know, you'd still be out there, I think.
That's what I'm saying. Y'all got screwed compared to the other locations because who the hell protects a freaking squirrel?
Yeah. That's... Yeah. I mean, I don't know the behind the scenes of the why to it. So that was something that we didn't really, by the time we learned the regulations, we were already on site, you know, doing our camera orientation. We went through a trapping class and whatnot. So they gave us the regulations. There was some grumbling, but we didn't sit at the meetings. They go to, like, all these meetings. So the crew, the survival crew for the History Channel, like, they sit in meetings with the feds and with the local tribe, and they try and go back and forth. And they're advocating for us, and then they tell us what they can do. And so, yeah, it is what it is. But, I mean, like, either way, I still think it was possible to survive. It just was, you know, on hard mode. It's right. Like playing a video. Having it on hard.
You've got such a great attitude about this. I mean, you own it all yourself, and I respect that so much. I think it's a cool aspect of the show being up north because I don't like snakes, but I also don't like bears. But I would choose a bear over a freaking snake any day, I think.
Me too. You know, there's an interesting question they asked me. One of the first interview questions, that very first interview, they said, I was at the end, they said, hey, Colter, I just want to ask you one thing. They said, what do you think about the tropics? And internally, I'm shitting my pants. And I said, oh, I love the tropics. That sounds great. Like, you know, like, and I gave him this whole spiel about what it'd be like to live at the equator. I gave him this whole canned response. But in my head, I'm thinking, I'd be so far out of my element. There's all sorts of bugs and spiders and centipedes and snakes and all this shit that can kill you, and like I would have no idea. I'm white as hell. I get sunburned as ever. and I'm so glad we didn't go to the tropics. I love the North. I've been in the Pacific Northwest and Alaska my whole life, and I feel very comfortable up north.
Is there any sort of like psych evaluation that you have to go through to make sure that you know you're mentally capable of being alone for that many days?
Yeah. You talk to a psychologist quite often, both before the show and then after the show. And even during the show, some of those med checks, I mean, they're asking you questions that, you know, are kind of testing how you are mentally. But yeah, then it's great. After the show, you talk with a psychologist kind of during the refeeding program. Cause I'd lost 86 pounds. And so there was a quite extensive refeeding program. And then you talk to a psychologist, and then every month after that. And then when the show comes out and airs, you still talk to a psychologist cause they want to know, you know, how are you doing? How are you portrayed? How do you feel about it? You know, how do you feel now that the show is on national TV? And so, yeah, it was great. I feel like they have a really, you know, I'm in season 8 of the show. And so I feel like they've dialed it in. I bet the one contestants, you know, a funny story is they didn't even get headlamps. And so what they realized right away was no one's shooting any footage after dark because they can't see shit.
Right.
And so the show's learned a lot through the seasons on, I think, especially cast care. So
when you said a refeeding program, see, because I'm thinking, yep. God, I bet as soon as you got on that helicopter, that boat, you're free. Your ass is wanting something to eat.
You can't gorge yourself because you'll...
Oh, man, I wanted to. I was so ready to eat. So as soon as they pulled me... You know, and as after I got, you know, devastated and done it, I pulled myself together. I said, all right, who's got some fucking food right now? Let's eat. And they're like, no. And they actually had a thermos. And they said, well, here you go. And they poured me a cup of broth. And I was like, what the hell is that? You know, like they handed it to me. That was literally the best tasting food I've ever put in my entire mouth. Like it was insane. First off, I burned my mouth because the shit was boiling. It was hot. And I couldn't handle it. Like, I wanted all of it. So I just dumped this huge thing in my mouth and like just burned my tongue right away. Boom. But the taste, the flavor, it was bone marrow broth that's made by a native woman, an elder, that they've had making it for the show for years. And I've made a lot of broth. I've made a lot of bone broth in my life. I made thousands of jars. And that was the best broth I've ever had. And they give me a cup every hour. So then for the next 59 minutes, all I thought about was that freaking thermos. I was like, where is it? I want to know where it was. I asked them if I could hold it, if I could just hold the thermos. If I asked them like what time it was, because I couldn't tell. But like, I was like crazy. For about the first 48 hours, I had a lot of food anxiety because they go and put you in a room back at base camp. And you can't really leave the room. Like, they just want you to rest. They want you to eat. They want you to for me, they want me to shower. You know, they want to stuff. And so I couldn't go forage. So they would feed us six times a day, like little bits. So the first 3 days were just mostly broth and a little bit of like yogurt or avocados, like, you know, like some good and vitamins and stuff like that. But I couldn't forage. So between like the 3 hour feedings, I would just pace back and forth in the room and look out the window and be like, there's got to be some berries out there. There's got to be some roots. Like, I need to go fucking get some food.
How long does it take you to turn that that survival mode off in your mind? You know, you kind of, like you were saying, you know, you're just pacing back and forth like, oh, I could go get this or I could go get that. How long does it take for that to kind of click off and calm down?
Well, I don't think it's ever clicked off for me, you know, like that's kind of how I live. But I would say it took a week or 10 days like to really get out of the, you know, I'd say it took, I ended up being there 13 days and gained about 50 pounds in that 13 days.
Wow.
And so a lot of that was water weight, you know, they're pumping you full of vitamins, so you're retaining more water. So, but I'd say it took me a week before I bought into, I knew the game was over, like the show was over, but in terms of the physical, you know, 67 days of kind of starving and every single waking moment trying to get calories, I'd say it took a week to turn that off to where I wasn't stressed, wasn't worried, wasn't constantly thinking about it, wasn't, you know, I'd say it was about a week.
Right.
I'm assuming they're going to end up having a loan with people that were on it before to come back and try it again. Would you do it again?
I'd go. I'd leave tomorrow, man. I'd leave right now. I'd turn this phone off and go. I'd do it in a heartbeat. I want another shot. And it's not another shot, to, you know, just to win. Like, oh, I want that money so bad. Like, no, I'm going to be fine. I'm pretty lucky to, I can find jobs and find where I'm going to be fine with or without the money. But I want to do better. Like, I want to push myself to do better, to compete against myself. Like, I'd love to go back to the same square land with the same regulations on the same day and do better than 67 days and learn from you know, my mistakes and learn from what I could do. So, but I'd also love to go somewhere more plentiful. So, you know, history, if you're listening, yeah, I would love to go somewhere there's more food as well. So, yeah. But I want to go.
So just a lucky break. Like if you would have found a bear had killed an elk or a moose, you'd have made it right there. Cause you could just, the bone broth alone would have helped you tremendously.
They also have rules in the show and I understand why. They have rules that if you find things, you need to notify them when you find things out there. Because some people have found things that would give you an edge. They say, if you find something, that's great. Use it. If you find a plastic bottle, you find cordage, you find, you know, whatever, ropes, tin cans. People find all sorts of things. But, like, people have – one guy, you know, on that in the Arctic up in North Great Slave Lake found a boat, like an aluminum boat that
made
was
a hot
over.
Tub.
Huh?
He made a hot tub out of it.
I know. That was crazy. But that boat would not float. Like, it was cut in half. And, like, so they determined that that was okay to keep. It didn't give them an unnecessary advantage over the rest. But, like, if someone cashed food or, yeah. So I don't know what they'd do if it was a big kill. Like, they might say, yeah, that's part of it. And, like, that's great. But, like, if you walk in there and there's a dead buffalo laying on your site, like, someone had killed him, like that, I don't know if that, like, your skill, I don't know. I don't know if I'd want to win like that, like, and say, hey, I beat all the other contestants because there was a dead fucking cow on my on my little square. Like, look at me, I'm a great survivor. Like, I don't know.
Right.
That's what I'm saying, luck. But, like, if a grizzly bear killed a moose and you found it and you could scavenge just the bones out of it alone, a fresh kill would help you a ton.
Oh, I need, yeah, absolutely. I need the whole damn thing, including the maggots that were on it. Like, absolutely.
I got a weak stomach. And I've never been that hungry, so I don't know, like, what I would eat, but maggots?
When you're hungry, you're hungry.
I don't know. Are they rich in calories at all?
I started farming maggots when I was out there, and it's one thing they didn't show. But so all my fish guts, I dug a hole, and I put all my fish guts, except for the ones I ate, I put the rest of the fish guts in a hole, and I had maggots going for about 3 weeks. And probably had 300 or 400 maggots. I don't know. I never counted. But when I got my first snow, they disappeared and vanished. I was really heartbroken. I was trying to fatten them up. But, yeah, I think they're really good at turning some awful stuff into, yeah, some calories and fat and protein. So
have you always been, you know, you'll eat anything? Or is that something that you kind of cultivated when you're out there? Because maggots, like, had you had maggots before the show?
No, I never had. I've eaten bugs. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've eaten bugs on travel and stuff like that, but crickets and stuff. But no, I'd never eaten maggots. But yeah, you don't get a body like this being picky.
I lower half. So what do you walk? What's your walking around weight?
240.
240, and you said you lost 80, 87
150 pounds.
I was down to 156 pounds, so I lost 86 pounds. I was 242 when I went in, and I came out at 156. I haven't been 156 pounds since I was 12.
Because you're a bigger guy. Like, you're tall, too. How tall are you?
6'2".
Yeah, you're 6'2". Yeah, so, I mean, you're a naturally kind of bigger guy.
Hold on just a minute. How you're an interesting guy. You were in a South Korean airport when you found out about this show. What do you do? I mean, not everybody just goes to South Korea.
Oh yeah, so I work at a field school called Tidelines Institute right here.
Yeah.
And it's located at the Hobbit Hole Homestead on the Indian Islands, surrounded by 23,000 acres of wilderness. So there's like four big islands, this archipelago there and it's the only homestead on the island. And so so there's nobody out there. So I'm the only year-round resident for this school, okay? Well, I live out there 12 months a year. And for about 5 months a year, we have students, mostly college, that come out. And then the other 7 months, I'm pretty much alone on the island, sometimes absolutely alone on for months. And so they kick me off the island for a month every year so I don't go crazier. So I have to leave the island for a month. They don't care if I go to another island. They don't care where I go, but they said, you're leaving the island for a month. So I have to leave. So I've been going to Thailand the last few years, just renting a motorcycle and snorkeling, driving around the country, I go to different islands and snorkel and eat food and see people and enjoy civilization. So
that's crazy.
What's the place called in Alaska you live at?
Tidelines Institution.
It's called the Hobbit Hole. Oh, it's called Tidelines Institute. And if you look at the, if you Google map Hobbit Hole, Alaska on the Indian Islands, it'll come up and it's a really funky, cool spot. It's this little tidal hole in this island that you can only get into on high tides. And so, and there's this homestead in there, and it used to be a fox farm back in the 20s and 30s. It's over 100-year-old homestead.
So really, I mean, like you truly, like you said, you did this show for the social aspect. Like it really is no different than what you normally do.
I wasn't sitting on this podcast before I went on there. So yeah, like, I absolutely did it for the social aspect. I have met hundreds of people because of this show. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't do it, I wouldn't have met anybody. Like, right. I would be sitting alone on an island. So what's really cool is I got to know all the other contestants. I got to know the production crew. I got to know, you know, a couple of the native folks that we were on their land. I've gotten to know fans now and other survivalists. I've gotten to know you guys. Like, literally, like it was a joke. Like, they said, you came on alone for the social aspect. But it's been 100% my reality. And one of the best parts I got from it is the networking and the contacts and people I've got to meet because of it.
Right. But what I'm saying is you were already on an island alone. So, like, when they sent you out to the wilderness, like, okay, like, I'm not really missing anything. There's not anything that I'm really missing other than, you know, food, no, shelter, and water.
I forgot the food and the beer.
Did you get scared by bears any time you were there?
One time.
Well, I understand that, but just at once?
Yeah. Like, and I don't say this, like, from a macho point of view, like, no, I'm not scared of bears. Bring them on. Like, no. But, like, I've lived in Alaska for 15 years in the bush, And I've had hundreds of instances of occurrences with bears. I've fished around them, hunted around them, hunted them as well, watched them, observed them. Like, I've lived with them. So they're wild animals, and they can be unpredictable, of course. But, like, I've gotten comfortable enough around them. It's like you're not scared of cars, right? Because you've been in cars forever. Well, if you take someone that hasn't, put them in a highway, like, they're going to be kind of freaked out. Well, I wasn't necessarily scared of bears, but I was that one instance on day 15. I was really worried about my boat. I've had bears in my skiff before chew on my fuel lines, chew on my fuel tank. Like, they love rubber and plastic. So on that one instance, I was thinking, God, if that bear, I'm not worried about my personal safety. God, I got bear spray and I have, you know, some bear bangers, and like, bears, they don't want to come really mess with you, and you don't want to mess with them. And so, like, it's kind of a mutual thing, but they would love to chew this boat up, and it smells like fish. I've had fish in the bottom of it. So, like, oh my God. And that's my strat. That's one of my big strategies I thought was a game changer, was the boat. And so that was my big fear. But no, I wasn't worried about bears, especially when you have salmon runs. Like, those bears have been going to those salmon runs for hundreds, thousands, I don't know how, for many, many years. And so that's what they're there for. And thankfully, they didn't look at me as a, you know, as a food item.
Right. So that's what you meant when you said, you know, when you say that you weren't personally afraid. You were just like, son of a bitch, he's gonna fuck up one of my resources.
Yeah, absolutely. My biggest, like, it was day 15. I haven't even hardly got that day. I finished my boat. I put the outriggers on it. Day 12, 15, whatever it was. So, like, I celebrated. I was like, hell, man, it's a sunny day. My boat is stable. Like, I'm going to celebrate by getting in the water. I'm going to wash my clothes. Had them hanging to dry. I'm butt naked on the beach. And then I hear this, and I look up, and there's a bear walking on the edge of the water. And I was like, and it was beautiful. Man, that bear was a big boar. And for an interior grizzly, like, it looked, it had some fat on its bones. A lot of interior grizzlies are skinny and scrawny and long. And they're just, this bear was gorgeous. His hide was beautiful. And I thought, wow, that's beautiful. And, like, it's coming towards me. And I was like, hey, bear, nothing. I was just thinking it would take off, waving my hands, nothing. It's coming towards me. My boat sitting on the beach. I don't have any clothes on. And this thing towards me. And I'm like, what in the hell do I do here? Like, I want to protect the boat. The biggest thing for me is, like, I don't think this bear's not going to, it's not like, I'm not surprising it. It's not a mom with cubs. It's not like, I'm not sitting on a kill. Like, there's nothing there that is really going to provoke this bear to attack. But if it has to run me off or whatever, and I have to leave my boat there, I'm like, should I push my boat out in the water? Just have it floating? Should I hop in the boat? Like, First thing I did was put on some pants. That was
I feel like that is step one in any dangerous encounter, is put on a pair of pants.
How do you shit down your leg? You know, you got to have something to contain it.
So, okay, speaking of that, what do you do with your excrements? Do you bury them? You bury it all?
I don't know. Did you watch the show? You saw the episode where they started one scene of me saying, have you ever shit in your living room? Because I have. I don't know if you saw that episode. But yeah, I mean, I had a hole. I had like a little, you know, it's like your outhouse hole.
Yeah.
Everyone, hole over behind a log. And you don't get any toilet paper. So I had a bunch of moss that I had piled up. So a bunch of, and like, it's phenomenal, man. That sphagnum moss and that moss that grows on there, like, it's better than toilet paper, to be honest. Like, it was great, soft and wonderful. So yeah, I had a hole there, and that's what I did. And you know, like, I live up here in Alaska, so my places don't have running water, mm-hmm. and so I have composting outhouses. So if they'd ever put people out there in spring, you know, you try planting a garden and that stuff. But yeah, the fall is just like, get it away from camp, and yeah. But you know, I also thought it's pretty interesting. In 8 seasons of Alone, you've never seen anyone actually take a shit.
Never.
And that, I was like, is no one going crap out there? Are we that fecal phobic that we can't, like, because at 50 below zero at Great Slave Lake, that's kind of interesting. Is like, what do you do when it's frozen up? The ground's frozen, 3 feet of snow or ice. And like, what do you do about that? I think the people would be interested, you know?
So I can't imagine you having to shit much because you're not intaking hardly anything.
Yeah, I was averaging probably every 5 to 7 days a bowel movement.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah.
Ooh. About like shitting a piece of concrete, probably.
Well, it was like I was eating every seed, so rose hips. I ate probably 5 or 6,000 rose hips, and those things each have 20 seeds in them, you know, a bunch. So, and I was eating every seed. I'm not spitting those things out.
Right.
There's got to be some caloric value to them. So when I would shit, it would look It would look like, I mean, it was hard as hell, and it was like just a giant seed. It was just like, it was all seeds, and it was just like sesame seed roll or something. Like, it was insane.
So did you have this knowledge of mushrooms, or did they have like a course on mushrooms that you should look for?
I love mushrooms. Mushrooms and bees. You know, those people that are into fungus and people that are into keeping bees are weird. Those are my people, man. I love them. So, no, I've cultivated mushrooms. I've grown them indoors. I've grown them outdoors. I love wild harvesting mushrooms. They're phenomenal. They're just a really interesting organism. You know, the largest living organism on the planet. And they're very bountiful. They actually have protein in them. I've been picking mushrooms for a number of years.
But they don't give you, I mean, do they give like any contestant that say doesn't have knowledge of mushrooms? Is there like a crash course? Like, hey, don't eat those with the red and white spots. Nothing?
No, nope, not really. Like at orientation, we do a little bit of the local flora and fauna like talk. So we go on a walk together as a group and look at some things together and discuss, but like, yeah, a lot of people hold on to their secrets or, you know, their own knowledge, but we did do one plant walk together where we were just identifying some different resources and different things and kind of sharing some common knowledge and stuff, but no, there was no like, yeah, there was no, yeah, don't eat these, and you know, like there was no sharing of that, like you kind of, but a lot of us at that orientation they had a lot of manuals and books, and like all, some people brought library, like Teresa, she brought like 20 awesome books with her that were on the plant life of the area that she'd found, and she shared them with people. So she had it set up in her wall tent when in orientation that you could come check out a book from her and go through it, and so that was pretty cool.
Now, have you how long has it taken you to get this knowledge of different mushrooms? Because I feel like even if I knew what I was looking for, I'd still kind of have it in the back of my mind, like, shit, is this a mushroom that's going to kill me, or am I going to go on a bad trip? What is this?
I think mushrooms are a funny one, right? Because we tell our kids, and rightfully so, we tell them, don't eat those.
Yeah.
And these are bad, and these can kill you. And right, you don't want 3- and 4-year-old kids walking around putting mushrooms in their mouth. They like to put things in their mouth. Like, I get that. That makes sense. Duh. But we never go back and tell them, like, these are an incredible food resource. These can be very tasty and survival resource. These are very healthy, like, insane. Maybe one of the most healthy things for our environment are the mycelium that are growing under. Those mushrooms are just the fruit. But underneath the neural, they're a neural network going underneath our soil that help us farm and grow and forests and all this other stuff. We never go back and tell them the fascinating stuff about mushrooms. And so a lot of people live their lives afraid of them.
That's me.
Don't want because they think they kill you.
It's just like you said. I've never been reintroduced to mushrooms. I've always been told.
Well, it's because we don't have them here.
I've got mushrooms growing in my yard, Jeff. I've always been told stay away from them. They'll kill you.
The ones growing in your yard probably.
Oh,
will.
You don't fucking know, Jeff.
So,
but hold on, I want to know. So, like, what?
Well, here's
yeah, go ahead.
This is I only know, honest to God, I probably only know 15 or 20 mushrooms that I can pick, and I start with the ones that are most abundant and the easiest to identify, because I don't care about specialty mushrooms like, oh, I want to pick this one, or any plants that are like, oh, this special one or that special one. I think that's great. And people that are artists and people that nerd out on this stuff, I think that's beautiful. That's not me. I want to eat. And so I want to know which ones are the most prevalent in my area that are the easiest to identify. So tubes, so like boletes, they have tubes. They don't have gills. If it has tubes, it's probably safe. There's teeth mushrooms like hedgehogs. If they have teeth, they're probably safe. So teeth mushrooms and tube mushrooms are safe. If it has gills, there's thousands of different kinds, and you have to really know your stuff. And so if it has gills, it becomes really challenging. Well, it's taken me years, but like I'm still adding stuff on. So if I know 15 now, my goal next year will be add one or two on where I'm at. But there, yeah, we don't go back and retrain kids. We just tell them that, and then we forget about it. And literally, I've worked in education, and I've had students that graduate high school that are afraid or don't know or disinterested or just think they're toxic, when really the greater majority of them are not toxic.
Right. And see, the ones we have here have the gills on the bottom. So So maybe I should stay away from it.
Oh, it just takes a little more work. Do spore prints. You have kids, Andy?
Yes, I do. I got two.
Do spore prints with them. They will love it. I guarantee you. Get a white sheet of paper. Take all the caps off the mushrooms. Set them on there overnight. Leave them for 24 hours. They make a fingerprint, just like your thumb.
Really?
They make a absolutely beautiful. It's like art. But then you get a microscope or a little lens. They have colors and shapes and size. It's like a fun way. It's a mystery. And kids love it.
So you take the cap, off, and you set it upside down on a white sheet of paper?
Set it to where the gills are down on the paper.
Okay.
And you put a hole over the cap. And just all it has to do is sit overnight. And then you pick the cap up, and it might have purple spores. It'll drop millions and millions of spores, like seeds. It drops them onto the paper, and it makes this beautiful shape of the gills. It's like a fingerprint, and then you can identify the mushroom using that method.
Oh, wow.
What are we looking for? See, I've never heard of anybody eating a mushroom from around here. That's why I'm assuming they're poison. Nobody. So what are you looking for when you take the cap off that paper the next day?
So you're looking to see how wide the gill. So you have a little mushroom book, and it tells you, it's a flow chart. Are the gills this color? Are they this shape? Is the stalk hollow or is it stringy? Is the cap, you know, when you break it, does it stain blue? Does it stain green? But it's like not that complex. You go through this little step by step. I've seen third graders do this.
Right.
And they love it because it's straightforward. It's yes, no questions. Mm-hmm. Are the gills like this or are they like this? And you answer it. And then it takes your flow chart. And so you go through this flow chart. And at the end, it says it's from this family or that family. And then you do some, you know, you go to that page. It says flip to page 67. And this is what you have. But it's just like, it's fun. It's easy. It's fun. And it adds more food to your table. So when you're eating duck, you should be eating wild mushrooms with it. Or when you're and it's just one more food. When you're out there, like when I'm out hunting or getting firewood or doing something, I'm always collecting mushrooms or I'm collecting plants. Like, and so it just adds to your repertoire, you know?
I'm going to ask you this, because I don't think a coon ass could survive up where y'all are at, because they've got to have seasonings on everything and make it spicy and really good. Did you not just crave salt or something when you were stuck out there for all that time?
Well, I mean, I was trying to harvest salt. So I had some rocks. I built another hole that I filled with rocks that I'd piss on every day. So when I go pee, and I was thinking after a certain amount of time, salt crystals would start building up on that. And so I was planning to harvest some salt. Yeah. So yeah, I was thinking about salt. I wanted salt. And, but it's amazing what happens gradually over time. Okay. So the first probably week is the hardest. So when you go out camping or you go out to the woods, one of the favorite thing to do, right, is to eat some jerky, trail mix. Like when you're out there, everything tastes so good. And you just want to eat because you're burning calories, Snickers bar, all that shit. And so, but it happened so gradually that honestly, like I never had hunger pains. I never was like, oh my God, I have to eat. I knew my body was starving physically, but it happened so gradually that like your stomach's shrinking little by little. And then I get a fish every once in a while. So like, yeah, it wasn't that painful, to be honest with you. Like, even though I looked like hell, I felt great. I felt day 67, I felt like I could take on the world. I felt really light. I felt strong. I'd get winded easy, but I felt really good. So it's a weird phenomenon. Starvation is weird.
Now, did you do anything to prepare? Like, did you like fast when you knew that you got the part? Did you try to like fast to kind of see what it would be like mentally? Or did you, whenever you got out there, is that the first time you went through these hunger issues?
Yeah, everybody did something. I think people probably prepped more than I did. And so everybody did different regimens. And, you know, some people put on 30, 40, like Tim put on a ton of weight. And Biko was putting on weight. Everyone was trying. But like, and some people fasted to see what the intermittent fasting and blah, blah, blah. I didn't do any of that. Mm-hmm. I just, I did put on 20 pounds. And so I ate more carbs or I'd eat more often or drink beer or do something. I'd put on some weight, but like that weight fell off so quick. If you put on weight quick, it comes off quick.
Right.
And so that 20 pounds I put on just flew off. And then I got back down to my resting weight. But anyhow, yeah, I didn't prep for it that way. I think, I could have been more strategic, but I don't think it cost me. I think I went out there and I felt great. I felt strong. You know, I wasn't getting the calories I needed. I never had hunger pains. Mentally and emotionally, I felt 100%. I just couldn't connect. I couldn't get the food. You know, if you hunt, fish, and trap, like, it's not a sure thing. You go to the store, there's going to be meat in the meat department.
Right.
That's easy. That's convenient. We all know that. We love to take the easy route. You go out into the woods, it's these animals are on the top of their game. They live this every second of their lives. They're trying not to die. And so, and they have honed in hearing and senses and smell and all this stuff and sight. So like, you know, you're up against the odds. And so, yeah, it was a fun challenge.
Do Do you feel like your spidey senses, for lack of a better term, got heightened when you're out there? You know, like you said, animals, they've got all these things that through evolutionary history, they've got it honed in. Do you feel like towards the end, like you were picking up on different things than what you might have on day one or two?
Oh, 100%. Like, I think all the distractions, all the I mean, I was so present. I was so present oriented. All of my to-do lists, everything that we have going on in our lives disappeared. So I didn't have to mow a lawn, or I didn't have to host students, or I didn't have to call a family member. I didn't have to remember a birthday, or a gift, or an anniversary. I didn't have to do any of that shit disappear. The only thing I had to do is survive. And so, yeah, you just let every sound, you listen harder and longer. There's no one there to talk to. You know, when I go out hunting or I go out playing in the woods and I have someone like I'm visiting or chatting, or, you know, not always, but like when you're trying to hunt, but like, you know, it's social or it's something, your mind's distracted on what you have to go back to and work. And like when I was out there, like, I was so present oriented. It was beautiful. It was awesome. Every smell, I would smell it. I could smell it for hours. I didn't have to go anywhere. If I was sitting in a blind hunting, I could smell. If I was in the lake and I'd feel a bottom, I could go back over that rock and over that rock and over that rock and drift around this point. Or I could, yeah, you just had the time and you had the energy, you had the motivation. You weren't doing this for sport. You weren't doing it because it's fun. You were doing it because you literally needed it to survive. If you didn't do this, and so like, it was cool. There are many evolutions in your body, and you just, I was so much more aware at the end and honed in. You are a little bit feral. You are.
Yeah.
If you could do it all over again, what would you swap out of the 10 items you could take with you and add something else?
Okay, nothing.
Nothing.
I'd swap out nothing. I'd take the exact same 10 items, and if I was going anywhere that the show's ever been, I'd take the exact 10 items. Now, hindsight saying that I didn't see my first grouse till day 52. On Dave, and I've hunted grouse with a bow. I love plinking at grouse with a bow. Now, oftentimes, five of them will sit there and look at you while you walk. You know, you knock over three of their buddies, and they keep looking at you. So, like, they're beautiful critters, but they, you know, for some reason, they sit there and watch you plink them. But so I thought, oh, there's surely going to be grouse out here. And I didn't see. I hunted hard. I logged a lot of miles and a lot of times, and I'd seen the first grouse I saw was on day 52. So in hindsight, I'd say, well, I don't need my bow and arrows. I didn't see a deer. I didn't see any grouse. Like, I didn't see anything. But no, like, I would take a bow. Big game, as we've seen, big game changes the game. And the last three seasons, a moose, a muskox, and a deer have won it.
Yep.
So it's a big deal. So I wouldn't change anything. I love the boat, even the boat idea. If I was on the ocean, if I'd have been, they've done it on Vancouver Island. If I was, like, I think the boat would have taken me really, really far. I'd had crab pots, shrimp pots, halibut, skate lines. You know, I'd have had, you know, and then the ocean just more plentiful. There's seaweeds and limpets and all sorts of stuff. So, like, it was pretty sterile out there. And I still thought the boat would be a game changer, but I'd do it over again. The boat, yeah, it was a good combo. I still hunted on land. They didn't show that, but, like, then I had the land and I had the water. I could get to new areas. I was going around points, getting to new creeks and areas that would have taken me many more calories to hike.
I mean, you know, you think about it, you know, the bow and arrow didn't come into play, but a big game animal it's literally a home run. Like, if you can just get that, you're going to extend your stay. And, you know, I mean, you definitely have to take it just on the off chance. You know, you could have come around a cove and there could have been a deer and you could have gone ashore and gone after it. But
absolutely.
I mean,
absolutely. How close was your nearest competitor?
Oh, I'd say by air, I really don't know, but I know that the competitor north of me was Jordan on the same side of the lake. And it wasn't Jordan. Sorry, it was Nate. It was Nate. And I think he was maybe 5 to 7 miles away to the north. Like, I'm not positive, but we all kind of, yeah, we all came out. We're not supposed to do this. So I hope you're not listening, lone producers, but we all got together and figured out on the map where we were and drew a map of all 10 contestants. And so it was cool to see where everyone was. But, yeah, there were miles, but, you know, a few miles between all of us.
I wonder how often a couple of the competitors of Mac met up by accident doing stuff.
So you can't – I mean, I think it would be impossible. To be honest with you, from being on the show, like, I would say that in 8 years that's never happened. And the reason is – and maybe it has, and I don't know. And I know people pull all sorts of shit, but – You have a GPS tracker on you at all times, 24/7, this yellow brick. And when you step outside your boundary, it's an invisible boundary, but it goes off and vibrates and says, you have walked outside your boundary. You must turn around and go back. They're watching you at all times.
Okay.
And And so, but what's great is they use geographic markers. So on one side, it was a creek for me was my boundary. On the other side, there was a ridge, like a mountain ridge. And so I knew where I walked to the edges and set those alarms off. So I knew where my boundaries were. So, and then if they put miles between contestants where their square is, we'd have to leave our GPS tracker, somehow communicate that we're going to do this, leave our GPS trackers, know that the contestants out there, north or south of you, and then you'd have to hike with kind of no purpose out there. So, like, it would be difficult, but it could happen, but it'd be difficult.
Well, what I meant was, didn't know if you by accident, if y'all were out hunting or something, and 5 miles across apart, you know, you both walk 2 miles and you're close to it, you know, you're within each other. That's more what I meant. So they keep a GPS tracker on you all times. That's for your safety. Does it have a heart monitor and stuff on it also, or just a?
But it has that button, that tap out button on there. So if you got in the shit, if my boat was sinking and, you know, I didn't have waders, but if something was filling up and I couldn't swim or I couldn't, you know, I had hypothermia or something, like, you hit that button and they'll send the cavalry right now. Like, they'll send a helicopter. They know, like, if someone dies on the show's over.
Right.
So. Not gonna happen. So they say I felt very safe while I was out there. I really did feel like you know, you can push your limits more than you typically would. You know, a couple guys go out of the woods on another weekend, elk hunting, like, or you go out and try and do mimic this. Like, you don't have doctors checking on you every 10 days. You don't have a tap up button where they're gonna come save your ass. Like, they're really focused on you. So, like, you could push your limits. I push my limit farther than I probably ever will. Hopefully, I'll get another shot and I can push it further. But in a typical scenario, you're not going to push your starvation. You're not going to push some of the things, because I had a button that I could push and they'd be right there.
How far is the base camp from y'all?
I think for me, it could have been 25 to 40. I'd have to look on a map. I've never done the scale, but I was the furthest south on the lake. So I was way down. The base camp was the furthest north. So however long that lake is, so if you just go and see how far Chilco, how long the lake is, but I was literally the length of the lake away from him.
Did that button ever enter your mind, or was there never any point that you were like, I wonder if I should push this?
Okay, all right, I'm lying. I'm shaking my head. Yeah, no, it wasn't ever like, I never got lonely. I never got cold. I never got hungry enough to, like, and again, that's not me being macho, like, hey, look at me, just like that. That wasn't even in the top 10 length of camping trips I've ever been on. Like, I've been camping for 85 days and 92 days and 67, 75. Like, I've been camping much longer than that. And so, so I was like, yeah, it just wasn't, So I didn't miss family a whole lot. I love you, family, if you're listening, I miss you. But when my boat sunk on day 62 and my gill nets were out in the water. So I was supposed to have my safety gear with you at all times. I didn't pack it. It was like more weight. So if I would have had some, like, and history show, sorry, you guys, but I didn't have my safety gear with me. But I thought about it just for a second, a split second. I thought, this could be it. I said, God, my boat sunk. My nets are in the water. I know I'm pretty weak. This has been kind of one of my big strategies. My snares aren't producing. Now it's 4-point only or better. It's November. So I was thinking, this might be the day, but that lasted less than a minute. So I never, you know, looked at it. I thought about it, and then I laughed. There was this little kid, my ex-partner had a daughter, and she used to say, anytime I would think something like that or do something like that, she'd say, you're giving up. And she would just rag. So it was a good reminder. That voice went into my head and said, you're giving up. And within 5 minutes, I was like, oh, fuck this. I'm going to get this boat up. And just got.
Yeah, because I saw you pulling your boat out, and I mean, was it just, how heavy was that thing? I mean, it's filled up with water, you're calorie deficient. I mean, was that the hardest thing you've ever had to do?
Yeah, they didn't show. As sad as I thought it was a pretty smart way I figured out how to get that out, but I don't know, maybe it was just at the time. But I leveraged, what I did is I had a big pole, a big tree tied to it that I'd moor it every night, and I took that over to a rock, and what I did is I used my weight, you know, all at that time, 170 pounds or whatever I was. And I hung off that pole and leveraged that boat just out of the water, like a quarter inch, and then swung it over to the beach to where it was just above the water. And then I could bail it a little bit, and then I yanked it out. And so they didn't really show the whole thing. I thought it worked pretty well. But yeah, I mean, it was like, I thought when I cut those lines, that boat was going to drop to the bottom. It was 20 feet there and I was done.
Yeah.
And so I dropped and it was neutrally buoyant. I was like, oh my God. And I said, why? So then I knew at the moment I had a chance, and I went out, and they also didn't show, they kind of, yeah, it was a little bit different, but I went out within an hour of that boat being sunk. I went and pulled in another bull trout and caught a fish. So I went from thinking about tapping out to having a fish in my hands at day 62 or whatever day it was, and going, hell yeah, like that felt really good. That was a huge swing for morale.
Is that not just the most exhilarating feeling? Like you're so hungry and everything's on the line, and then you check the net and it's empty, and then you finally pull one up and there's a fish. Are you just is it just euphoria all over your body?
It is unreal. It's not like anything I've ever felt, because first off, you built the boat and you didn't know if you could build it, if it would float, if it'd be safe, if it'd be functional. You had no fucking clue if it was going to work. And then you built a net. Is the net going to work? How are you going to keep the net taut? I'm fishing the net 50 feet deep, 50, 60, 70 feet deep. Like setting a gill net on the bottom and not getting it tangled, not getting it wrapped up, making sure it has tension so it can catch fish is not the easiest thing to do. So you're fishing out of a homemade boat using a homemade gill net and you're starving. Like from day 28 to 49, 21 days, I hadn't eaten any protein, any fat, anything. So 3 weeks, I tell people I didn't eat for 3 weeks. And they're like, well, what about plants? Like, yeah, okay, I ate some berries and I ate some rose hips and I ate some wild onions and I ate some mushrooms. But like I was probably intaking 300 calories and putting out 5,000.
Right.
I was starving. And so that feeling that, oh my God, like all of this culmination of doubt and anxiety and all this stuff about going, am I good enough? Is my boat good enough? Is my net going to work? Is there anything happening? And you pull in, when I see them coming up, you always see the white belly of those fish when you're pulling in a gill net coming up. When I saw those, like I don't scream, like I don't, yeah, like when I hunt or I get something, I don't like, you know, do a big song and dance or whatever, but you couldn't help it. Like it was primal. It came up and it was euphoric, and it was, you felt so much self-confidence. You felt so much pride. You felt like you'd done something, that you deserved something. Like, I don't know. It was a beautiful moment. You can't recreate that. You sure as hell can't recreate that in a grocery store. And then this, after that starving and after so many failures, that was, a lot of people ask, I'm sorry, I'm long-winded here.
No.
But a lot of people ask me what was the most challenging thing. And I don't like to use the word failure, because, you know, when a kid falls over trying to learn how to walk, it's not a failure, it's a lesson, you're learning. But like, you know, every day my goal, I had one goal every single day when I woke up, it was to get calories. And so if I didn't get calories that day, I kind of failed. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you're starving, and let's say that 3 week runs, 5 days into it, I failed 5 in a row, 8 days, failed, 12 days, failed, 17 days. On day 17, you're going out there and you're hunting and you're trapping, you're fishing all flipping day, and you don't get anything. And it's been 17 days since you've succeeded in your eyes. And so that mental game of saying, on day 18, I'm going to push it just as hard, and on day 19, I'm going to push it just as hard. Well, on day 21, I caught those two bull trout. Insane. I'll never be able to recreate that feeling.
Did you give yourself like a routine, like a checklist that you like, okay, I'm going to wake up and these are the steps that I take every single morning, or was it kind of shift as the days went on?
I had a pretty developed routine that I loved. God, I love my routine. I loved it. So I had a game plan going in there. I laid out about a 28-day game plan, okay, of things I was going to – when I was going to build my shelter, when I was going to build my tree stand, when I was going to build my boat, how I was going to focus. Obviously, I'm going to go in there and adapt and learn from the land. Like if there's a bunch of berries or a bunch of onions or a bunch of fish or like deer everywhere, you're going to adapt. But I had this kind of mindset. Well, that kind of played out. Of course, it twisted and turned and evolved a little bit. But about day 30, I'd say from day 30 to day 67, I had a great routine. I'd get up in the morning, I'd unbury my fire. So I had just these coals going all night. I was very efficient with my firewood. I allotted myself 12 rounds a day, 6 in the morning, 6 at night. I buried my fire each time beforehand. I unbury it, I'd have tea. I'd make 2 quarts of water, and I'd make sure I drink a gallon of water a day. Make sure I stay hydrated. So I drink 2 quarts of tea, and I had pine needle tea, I had fir needle tea, I had Yarrow tea, I had Labrador tea, Kinnikinick tea, I had, you know, all these different kinds of teas, and then I put dried mushrooms in there, and then if I had anything, you know, onions, I put onions, so it became kind of a soup. I'd drink that, get dressed, then I'd go outside and check my snares, and then, you know, I'd do this loop where I was bow hunting and checking my snares, looking for grouse, looking for deer, and then I'd go down to the lake, go check my gill net, and then I'd troll around and fly fish. I'd come back, have more water, sit by the fire, warm up, then I'd go out in the evening and either deer hunt or go back on the lake, like. And then at night, I'd have tea, I'd play Yahtzee, I'd bury my fire, and I'd go to bed. But it was like this beautiful, like, I loved the routine. I loved the pace of it. I loved the thoughtfulness and intention. I loved like hunting and fishing and trapping every day, all day. Like, who doesn't love that? Right. So like, I didn't want to go. Literally, like, part of the reason I didn't want to go is because I loved that routine so much.
And you would play Yahtzee every day.
Every day in the morning and at night, I'd play a game. And I had a big rock, that huge boulder was the size of a king bed, you know, a queen bed, 4 feet high. I wrote in a piece of charcoal my daily high score. So on that rock at the end, I had like 30 numbers written on there for my high score. My high score ended up being 311, if you're worried about it, Jeff.
Oh, Jesus. But, so you said your bed was uncomfortable. It didn't really show the inside of your cabin. What was your bed?
So my bed, I had to build over. So I wanted to build next to that boulder, right? So I could timber frame. I timber framed my shelter so I didn't have to use a lot of paracord. Well, right underneath the boulder, there was some, it was kind of sticking out. And so I had to, I put a couple rounds down and then put some little poles, spruce poles over it. So I built a spruce pole bed. It was just, and then I put a bunch of boughs on it. So I had a layer of probably 6 inches thick of limbs. All right. So it seems like it'd be pretty good, but I didn't use enough boughs, and my stick, like my logs that I put down weren't exactly like the best, I don't know, limbed, or they're lumpy, or they weren't the right size, but like it looked by the eye, it looked pretty nice. But you know, I didn't think about it is when I started at 240 pounds, I have 2 inches of fat around my entire body. And so I think that probably helps. Well, at the end, I'm 156 pounds and I have no fat. I'm bony as hell. And so I think it just got more and more uncomfortable as it goes on. But I slept better and better as time went on. So I don't think it mattered.
Yeah. It amazes me how dirty you were. I mean, you looked
like
scary.
A coal miner.
It was scary. Yeah. Was that?
Yeah. They said I was the dirtiest contestant they've ever had.
When was the last time that you could jump in the spring and like, or in the lake and, you know, kind of wash off?
I wasn't doing that. Why the hell? I'm not getting any food that way. I mean, unless I'm getting calories.
Well, there was one time you were swimming in it because you were butt ass naked. They blurred your ding-a-ling out.
Yeah. Well, it was day. Yeah, that was day 15. It was sunny and finished my body. That was kind of celebratory. You're right. But like I showered, I washed twice when I was out there in 67 days. On day 15 and on day 66, my dad's birthday. So I went, let's see, what is that? 50, I went 50 days about without showering or washing. And the reason I was so filthy was I buried my fire. So I didn't take a ferro rod in. So I was doing Bodril fire. So I try and keep my fire going. You know, again, it took me an hour to start a Bodril fire in the beginning. And by the end, I could do it in about 5 minutes. And that was one of my goals, was to get better at that. Mm-hmm. And so, but I still wanted to keep my fire going. So I'd bury it every day in a pile of ash. In the morning, I'd unbury it, have my tea, have a fire, warm up. Then I'd bury it again while I was out hunting, fishing, trapping all day. And at night, I'd unbury it, you know, build another fire, have tea, dinner, whatever. And then I'd bury it and go to bed. So every day I was unburying and burying my fire twice with ash. So
that's the soot.
And then I had this motto that was calories over comfort. So I don't care about building a chair. I don't care about building a broom or, you know, building like cool trinkets. Like, people that are out there, I'm not knocking anyone that did that. They're like wonderful craftsmen out there, and the other contestants are awesome. I freaking love them. But I don't give a shit about comfort. My bed, I didn't build a chair. I didn't even cut a stump so I could sit on outside. I just sat on the ground and, you know, the whole time. So like, because if it didn't give me calories, if I'm sawing through a log for a chair, those calories could be better used hunting grouse, trapping, sitting in a tree stand, out in my boat. Like, I just wanted food. I want to stay out there.
Right.
You know, you were the dirtiest person I've ever seen in my life. I saw a homeless guy in Taos, New Mexico that was about as dirty, and he was riding the train, I guess, because he looked like they drug him. But, yeah, you were damn sure the dirtiest guy that I've ever seen on that show. And it makes sense because you were doing the fire off and on all the time.
Yeah, yeah. And I just didn't care. Like, as long as it wasn't detrimental. You know, there's hygiene that could be detrimental to your health or detrimental to my longevity. Like, I know about infection. And so if I had a cut or an open wound, we had a first aid kit. Like, I would treat it with my hands and stuff like that. Like, I wasn't stupid about it. But, like, in terms of how I looked, I don't give a shit. And I went out there, like, I don't care even in my norm. Like, I generally probably shower 2 or 3 times a month, even in my normal life. So I just don't really, it's not a big deal. But there was something you said about, oh, yeah, the kids. You know, I've shown people a picture. I'll have to send you guys a picture of the day. I took a picture of myself the day I came out. And you haven't got to see that yet. Like, it's freaky. Like, I'm not even sure I want to put that on the interweb. Like, there's already some memes going around of me that I love. But this, this, you can't unsee this. This will freak people out. The kid said, it looks like I thought out of a glacier. That was the best.
That's good.
It does. What the hell did that bathwater look like, that first shower back? Like, was it just black all the way down?
It was black for 3 days. It wasn't the first shower that shit came off. Like, it was like black, and then it was like a dark gray, and then on the third time I showered, it was gray and it went away. But like, it was funny because I felt great. Okay, when I'm out, even at the end when they took me out, like, I got fatigued easier and I was out of breath, and like, you know, I was not thriving. Of course I was starving, but I felt good. Like, I still felt like, hey, so like, I carried my pack down to the boat, you know, I got on the boat, felt good. Well, the instant I got put back into a room and I hit hard floors, I had hardwood floors, I was walking around like I was 90 or 100 years old. I was just like crunched over. I sat down on a chair that had no padding, was just a wooden chair, and I hopped up and screamed. I was like, oh my God, like, it hurt so bad. The first time I sat on the toilet, it hurt. So like, it was really interesting being out in the woods and feeling good. Like, everything I did, I felt good. Walking around, feeling good, hunting and sleeping, I felt good. In terms of, you know, my body. And then as soon as I got put into a room and taken out, the game was over. I don't know if it was adrenaline and intensity. I don't know if it was actual hardwood floors and the hard surfaces. But, like, I looked literally like I was moving like I was 95, like slow.
Right.
I was creeping.
Is that, so, have you talked to anybody? Is that common? Do a lot of contestants go through that?
I think so. You know, we have a group chat that we all kind of talk and share stories. And I've heard a few people say, like, you know, the time that it took them to recover. And for me, the biggest recovery has been mental. I think starvation, in my experience, it's been your brain is a huge caloric intake. Your brain uses 30% of the calories you put in there. Well, if you're starving, sure, you lose muscle mass and sure, you lose fat. But your brain, I mean, like, I've had a hard time holding conversations. I've made a bunch of mental errors since then. So I know I can retrain it. I know it'll come back. You know, doing things like this is good for me. Reading's good for me. Getting back into civilization is good for me. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was the thing that took the biggest hit. I came out and just felt dull. I just felt really, really dull, duller than normal.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you feel foggy ever when you were out there, like brain fatigue, or was your routine just so ingrained? Like, this is what I do. I have my tea. I go on my route. Like, or was there,
that's part of why I wanted a routine, is so I didn't have to think about all that.
Right.
You know, I think there were times that I'd zone out, and especially towards the end, there were times and things would get a bit foggy. But like, the routine, I'd already been doing it for 20, 30 days in a row. And so it was easy to just follow a simple routine and know that was the best game plan that I think I had to get calories. And I tried to sleep 12 hours.
Right.
I would try to be down from about 10 at night, or 9 at night to 9 in the morning, or 8 to 8, whatever it was, especially starting to get dark there. You know, I think it was 8 to 8. But that's when I wasn't burning calories, I was kind of hibernating. And then the other 12 hours, I was trying to get food. So,
What's your recipe on pine needles soup or tea before we get out of here? What's the recipe on that?
Well, I just love it. So the way I like to do it, I just take a bunch more pine needles than you need. So I chew them. So a couple of things. One is I chew them and then brush my teeth with like the saliva and the needles. Like, you get a lot of vitamin C. You know, you get a nice, you get a nice smell, you get some agitation on your gums. But for the tea, I just put, you know, grab a handful of needles. It's probably more than you need in a 2-quart pot, but a handful of needles, put them in the pot. Typically, you want to bring your pot to a boil first. You pull it off and then let them steep in there for 5 or 10 minutes and drink it. You don't want to boil them. I think you can, you know, get bitterness. I think maybe you can even knock some of the nutrients out. I'm not positive on that, but like, you just want to steep them in really hot water, about 200-degree water for 5 or 10 minutes, and drink it. But it's delicious. Fir needle tea, pine needle tea, absolutely delicious.
What's your favorite tea?
Well, when I was out there?
Yes. Tea, yeah. No, not here. Not Lipton or anything out there.
My favorite tea on the show was Labrador tea. So a lot of people might call it bog tea, but Labrador tea tastes like the tundra in Alaska. Every time I had Labrador tea, I thought I was drinking Alaska. Or I was drinking tundra. It smells like tundra. It smells like home to me. And so I would rotate my teas. I had 6 teas I'd rotate. Every day I'd drink 2 of them. So every 3 days I'd repeat. And so every time I got Labrador tea, it made me think of home.
Well, what is Labrador tea? Tell me that.
fog too.
Just, so it's can pick out. So you probably, well, you don't have it down in Texas. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
Or where is it in Texas? So yeah, it's just a plant. It's a plant. I don't know the scientific name for it, but it's lavender. But it's a plant that grows in the bogs around here. So a lot of the muskegs and a lot of the bogs have this low plant. It has orange on the back of its leaves, so it's got this long, gated, kind of waxy-looking leaf. And you just run your hand up the stem, you can get about 20 leaves pulled off, and you can dry it. I like to have it on the wood stove going, so if you ever come over to my place, I have a pot of water on the wood stove, and I'll have Labrador in there, tea. And you can add honey and, you know, lemons if you're out here, and it's delicious. But it just smells like the tundra. If you've ever been to Alaska, you've ever smelt the tundra, it smells like Labrador tea to me, so...
Did the camera help you at all? Because it kind of, you know, you're narrating kind of what you're doing. Did that help your mental at all? Because, you know, you're kind of getting your thoughts out there.
I think there's times when it did, you know. So when you kind of have stuff that you're supposed to shoot. They want 8 hours of footage a day. They want a morning check-in before you leave your shelter. And they want an evening check-in before you go to bed. So kind of like a little journal. I think those were the times that really helped. Because other times when you're outside of your shelter, you're hunting, fishing, trapping, like, you know, you don't want to talk. Like, I wanted to whisper and not even talk at all. Like, so it wasn't a big deal. There was a pain in the ass. You're trying to hunt an animal and kill an animal, and then you have this freaking set up two angles. You got to make it look artsy and cool and catch it in the picture, and it's like, Jesus Christ. But when you're in your shelter and you're doing those journal check-ins in the morning, it did feel like you weren't alone. Like, you were talking to a crowd. You were talking to an audience. And so that was kind of nice. So you'd wake up and say, oh, my God, I dreamt of this, or I thought of this. Or every night I went before I went to bed, I'd do a grateful thing, like what I'm grateful for. I'm grateful for teachers, or I'm grateful for wildlands, or I'm grateful for whatever it was. And so, like, I don't know if I'd have done that or vocalized some of that stuff if there wasn't a camera.
Right. Do you feel like this has helped you in the long term, like in your life now? Like, do you count your blessings more than maybe you did before you went on the show?
I mean, I hope I counted my blessings before I went on the show, and I hope I continue to do that. I do feel extremely grateful and fortunate and privileged to have the life and support and parents and all the experiences I've had. But yeah, I mean, I'm very fortunate for this experience. It was phenomenal. Something I've dreamt of as a little kid, like, man, I want to go see how, like, I dreamt of, I was named after John Coulter. He was the only guy that left the Lewis and Clark expedition. Mm-hmm. And so everyone was going back to St. Louis after two rugged ass years in the West. And he said, I want to stay in Montana and Wyoming in that area. Well, I was born in Montana, named after him. So I grew up reading of this mountain war legend and lore. And so as a little kid, I thought, man, I want to see if I can survive as a hermit in the backwoods with very little stuff. And so, so it was a dream come true to be able to have the experience. It was a phenomenal experience. I learned a lot about myself and about starvation and about succeeding and about what I'm capable of doing and the land. And so, like, yeah, it'll change the way I look at experiences going forward. But, yeah, I'm just grateful that I got to do that.
So my last question for you is, what was your first actual meal that they let you have? What was the first thing that you were like, I'm going to town on this bitch. Don't hold me back.
All right, so I had 13 days where I had no autonomy over my food. I ate what they served me, and then they let me go. And the very first meal I had, so my spirit vegetable is the potato, by the way. So yeah, eat some potato. I love growing them. I love eating them. I love preparing them about 50 different ways. So I went and had a fat ribeye steak, undercooked, rare ribeye steak. I had mashed potatoes. I had asparagus. I had beer bread, and I had about four cocktails lined up.
That was it.
What's your cocktail?
I had one of every. Oh, man, they had a menu. It was a fancy place. I went to some fancy. I mean, I looked like shit still. Probably smelled bad still. I mean, I did not. I walked into that place and was like, oh, dear God. Like, there's probably a dress code here. But I walked in there. They had no idea who I was or what I'd just come from. And I sat at that table, and I just picked one of. I couldn't name them. I sure as hell couldn't even spell them. But they were on the menu, and they lined them. And I said, "This is what I wanted." And I took pictures of it. And God, it was good.
How much did you miss, you know, like having a beer at night or something? That would be the hard part for me. I like my beer, and I like, you know, whiskey every once in a while.
Yeah, no, I like a drink once in a while too. And I didn't like. I knew it was coming to an end. I knew this was an experience, like. It's a game show. It's not a survival. I mean, it is obviously a survival as survival as you can get for a show, but there was a lot of regulations right on there. And so like, I knew this was coming to an end, whether it be 60, 80, 100 days, whatever it was, like it was coming to an end. So like, I went without coffee. I went without beer. I went without carbs. I went without, you know, all, you know, caffeines and all these different things that you love on a daily basis. I love eating a bagel, having a cup of coffee, having a beer, whiskey at night. But like, it's temporary.
Yeah.
Like my God, we can live without it. And then, you know, to be honest with you, I enjoy those things so much more now. And I enjoy that cup of coffee in the morning and I enjoy that whiskey at night because, I didn't get a habit. And like, yeah, so I think it was great.
Did you get any financial compensation at all for this?
So you do get like a stipend, a daily stipend. It's just supposed to cover your, it's not a ton, but it's supposed to cover your time away from work.
Right.
So while everyone's missing work, they give you a little daily stipend. Everyone gets it, and it's just a per day thing for whenever you're on a show. But yeah, it's not, you know.
I'm worried I'm worried my body would revolt if I cut out coffee. Like, I don't, I'm dependent. I realize I'm dependent on that drug caffeine. And that's another thing. People don't think it, caffeine is a fucking drug. Like if you're addicted to it and you go without it, you have headaches. It's bad.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. But try it. I mean, it's fine. You're going to be fine, right? And
yeah.
We lived without coffee for hundreds of thousands. I mean, like we've had it for a long time, but we've also lived without it for hundreds of thousands of years. And so like, give it a shot. You'll be all right. See what your body does. Learn something new about it. Then go back on it. Like whatever, you know, but it is fun to put yourself through it. Like those are minimal risk, but it's fun to learn like, you know, what happens, how your body reacts, how you react. I mean, that's the thing is they say, what's the hardest thing? And I think starvation is like, how is my body physically going to react? Emotionally, how am I going to handle starvation? And mentally, how am I going to handle starvation? And so, yeah, it was fun to learn that and the isolation. So,
yeah,
I've spent two times, not even close to something like this. I went to Alaska one time and we were in the woods for 10 days and I went to the Boundary Waters and I was over 7 days. Both times we had regular food to eat, but
you had the trail mix and the Snicker bar,
all that kind of shit. But the thing I missed the most was freaking ice in my drink.
Oh,
I never thought I would it just because everything I drink, I put ice in. I don't give a shit if it's a tea, a Coke, whatever water. I like ice in my drink. I can't imagine being there without the little foods that I eat. You're a very tough man, and you have been one of the most interesting people we've had on this podcast. And I appreciate you being on here, and I sure hope they let you do it again.
Well, I appreciate it, Jeff and Andy. I really enjoyed being on here, and I gotta leave you with one thing because he made me think of my father. There, he loves ice in his drink, but he's got a saying that he's gonna be as ideal weight about 50 days after he dies.
There you go. That's exactly right. That is exactly right. Well, hey, we wish you the best. You enjoy Alaska. I hope y'all have a cold winter so we can have a cold winter down here.
All right. Appreciate it, you guys. Thanks for the time.
Hey, thank you very God much. Bless you, man. You
have good a good luck. Day. And like I said, I hope they let you back on because you're a fun man to watch.
I'll go back out there in a heartbeat. Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Coulter Barnes.
Very interesting man.
Telling you what.
Very educated man, too.
I think you have to be. I don't think that's a game for a couple nitwits from Texas.
No,
I think you've got to have an understanding of nature, and you have to have an understanding of yourself.
Maybe they'll have a pseudo celebrity type deal and they'll invite you.
Pseudo,
you're mentally tough. You would do pretty good for about 17 days. The thing that would get me is I'm a cheating bastard, and if there's some fucking squirrels and I'm hungry, I'm killing me a squirrel.
Yeah, that's an interesting dynamic. Is that? Your body is shutting down. Your body is starving. But you still have to play by these arbitrary rules.
That's what I noticed this year more than the ones I've seen before, is they didn't have no food hardly.
Right.
Those people were fucking starving to death.
And that's what they said to him, or the last day that the last med check, like, you know, they get in their little huddle away from him, and they're like, yeah, he's starving. It's like, well, no shit. His body's starving. It's like, well, no fucking shit, lady. For the last 40 days, it's been starving.
67.
Well, I just mean, you know, because he had some fish and stuff.
Right, but that was the shows before, like they did the $1 million one I watched it. I really enjoyed it. Me and Mom watched these shows all the time. And the one up there, a guy shot a muskox.
Right.
Got killed a wolverine with a club one night. I mean, but they had fish. They could fish. But what wore me out on those more than this one was the guys that dick around on building them a shelter. They do a half-ass shelter. If you're in this to win, you better build you a fucking shelter right off the bat. That's going to be your home.
Right.
Get you a shelter built and get you some food. The keys. But there, they were so handcuffed on shit. And the other place you would see game, hell, he didn't see a deer. He saw two deer tracks.
Right. And, I mean, I don't have the wherewithal. I don't have the knowledge of nature.
No, I wouldn't know what kind of fucking mushroom to eat. I wouldn't even about it.
I wouldn't know about what mushroom to eat. I wouldn't know what I could wipe my ass with. The hunting part, and even that, like, I'm not a big game hunter. I could follow tracks. I could do that, but, I mean, I'm not a big game hunter. I don't know how to build a tree stand out of four logs and a piece of twine.
Well, no, I would just crawl up my tree.
What? Some of those trees are vertical. I don't know if they got branches like here.
They some do, yeah. I'm not saying I would not want to do that anyways.
If the animal I'm chasing doesn't have feathers, I'm screwed.
But you're a hunter. You would do better than you think you would.
I don't know.
You would do because you're a hunter. People that can hunt and fish, I wouldn't have a problem. The hunting
and I don't fish.
Part, well, the hunting and fishing part wouldn't be a problem for me. The comforts of home would be my problem. I'm gonna be like, fuck this. I ain't doing this shit. You know. I'm not staying in the woods for 100 days for $1 million and freezing my fucking balls off. It ain't happening. I don't need $1 million that bad. Now, if you guaranteed me if I'd go 100 days, I'd get $1 million, I'd have to think about it. I might take that chance on the Arctic where they're doing it at up there, but if you put me in the fucking Amazon, I'm not staying in the Amazon for 8 hours for $1 million.
I'm not sleeping overnight.
Fuck no. There is no way in hell. And I don't know that I would enjoy that as much watching it on TV. Because I don't like snakes and I don't like all that shit, but just the bugs and shit alone.
I had snakes coming out at me on my last till hunt. I was ready to burn that motherfucker down.
They weren't even poisonous.
Jeff.
What?
Three guys said that they were water moccasins. One guy said it was not.
Was it a cottonmouth or a water moccasin?
What's the fucking difference? It's
the same. Cottonmouths are poisonous.
A water moccasin is a cottonmouth. Am I sure?
No, you're not sure.
Jeff.
There's a difference between a water snake and a
cottonmouth. I understand there's a difference between a water
snake. One guy said they weren't. I'm going with the guy that said they weren't.
I'm going with the three guys that said, yeah, if they bite you.
Well, I wouldn't want to go get bit. They'll make you sick probably anyways. Are they zoologists?
They said they're around water moccasins all the time. Let me look this up.
What'd Kevin say?
He said it's a water moccasin.
Probably cottonmouth then. I go with Kevin because I trust him.
How do you spell moccasin?
M-O-C-A-S.
Oh, there it is. Is a water moccasin the same as a cottonmouth? I don't know that we have cottonmouths out here, though.
No, I've seen a cottonmouth before.
Water moccasin versus a cottonmouth. Moccasins and cottonmouths share one common thing. They are the same snake. Well,
there you go.
That makes sense. But
the ones I saw pictures of did not look like a...
So, see...
Did they have a head, a rectangular head? Them snakes did not look like that you shot.
Well, it's a different color.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That was not a cottonmouth.
But see, so this picture right here, and this is what the guys told me. They call this a blunt tail. And the snake that I saw, it did not. So see how the tail gets real slender, but the body gets real fat?
Yeah.
Its whole body was slender.
Those were just water snakes that you've seen. I saw the pictures of it. That's what I was thinking. I don't think that's what it was.
Well, listen to me.
Hey, I'm going to tell you, I've been...
At 6:30 in the morning, when all you see is the shadow or the outline on the lake, and you see fucking... You see... It was 3 fucking feet, Jeff. And it's making a beeline to me.
It ain't going about through them waders.
I've got a dog I've got to worry about.
Well, that's true.
I don't just go out there willy-nilly by myself. I understand I'm probably safe, but it literally, I'm sitting in the middle of the group, and I'm looking at everything, and I look at my phone, and we got 5 minutes to shooting time, and we're kind of hemming and hawing, and look at my phone again. We've got 3 minutes to shooting time. T'll buzz us. Like, they come in, and guys, they're getting all excited. Anyway, a couple more minutes go by. I say, okay, guys, next, we're legal. Next bunch that comes in, we're shooting them. And before all that, when we had like 5 minutes left, I see a head pop up just right outside the decoys, maybe 5 yards past the decoys. And I don't know what it was. I've hunted there my entire life. I've never seen a snake on the entire property. Something in me said, I wonder if that's a snake. And then I'm like, no, it's probably just a turtle popping its head up. And then 5 minutes goes by, tell the guys we're legal. And one of the guys says, oh, shit, there's a snake. And I'm like, motherfucker. And I look, and the lucky duck was right in front of me. And that snake is slithering under it, coming aground. And it gets its head, comes on the shore, and they shoot it.
Did you know that Kevin killed a rattlesnake on that same place when his dad's last steel hunts with him?
Oh, fuck.
Did you know that?
No.
And listen to this. It had flooded and it rained. Remember, we got all the rain?
Yes.
And the water had come up like within 3 days from where we had the blind
yes.
to where it was behind the blind. And Dad said him and Kevin were walking through there, and they heard a rattle, and the thing was up in the water. It was up on the grass in the water.
Listen, I know rattlesnakes can swim, so I was the whole time I was worried it was a rattlesnake.
Nah.
So then we shoot that snake, and then a guy says, oh, shit, there's another one, and it's swimming ashore. Now, this one's only about a foot long, so they shoot it. Then the guy says, oh, fuck, there's another one underneath the lucky duck. So they step out and they shoot it. Three fucking snakes before we ever shot a teal.
Well, good.
It was the most terrifying experience that I've ever gone through in my entire life.
Let me tell you.
It was horrible because here's the deal. Three snakes are trying to swim in or trying to come up on the ground where we're hiding. What snakes have already come past?
Oh, you probably are already sitting them in them.
Exactly.
Me and Tony were tube fishing one time in Wichita on a bass pond. We caught a lot of fish, but there was also a lot of water snakes, and I quit the last time I killed two of them with my fishing pole. I hit them on the head. They come up and popped up right next to me. Mm. That was the end of my deal. I said, fuck that. I ain't fishing this son of a bitch anymore.
But we could see more.
Sure. There's just not three of them.
We could see more out in the water. They pop their head up, and you could see the ripples and stuff.
Yeah, see the head on the one on the far right that's got the diamond-shaped head? That's what you're looking for.
I'm not looking for
if
shit.
If you don't see the head, those snakes you had did not have heads. They was just water snakes. They wasn't going to hurt you.
Jeff.
Andy.
They'll make you hurt yourself.
Well, that part is true.
I still cannot find a good picture. Texas water snake. It was horrible. Horrible, horrible, horrible. And I don't wish it. That's what I saw right there, I think.
What?
This.
Yeah, that's just a snake.
That's a diamondback Texas water snake. Yeah, that's nothing good would come from the term diamondback snake.
All right. Let's get off the podcast. I got stuff I got to do.
We got another one to do.
I know, and I've got to do some stuff before I do that. Anyways, thank y'all for listening. God bless y'all. Have a great, great, great week.
Hmm. Well, aren't you just Speedy Gonzalez? Go check out all of our wonderful sponsors. Check out Shin Gear Waders. Like we said at the top of the podcast, they have inventory in stock, and it ain't going to last long, so if you want a pair of waders, you better hurry. Pacific Calls, Dive Bomb Industries, Boss Shot Shells, Dirty Duck Coffee, Lucky Duck Spinners, love mine, they attract snakes, Looking Glass Duck Club Podcast, Gundog Outdoors, Goose Creek Retrievers, Bangtail Whiskey, Eyesight Drone Service, and Sandfield Hunting Outfitters.